Good evening. Can you all hear me? I'd like to welcome all of you to the New York Society Library, the oldest library in the city and one of the oldest in the country. And I hope you will consider giving to our annual fund because we have so many wonderful programs like this and to support all of our buying of books and to know that your membership only covers about a quarter of the cost. So please give generously. And tonight, we're so excited to have Patricia Volk speaking about her wonderful book, Shocked, My Mother, Schiaparelli, and Me. The book has received rave reviews everywhere and is a riveting mother-daughter story. I could identify so much with Patty because I, too, had a mother who was very beautiful. And whenever I went anywhere, the doorman, the butcher, whoever would say, oh, your mother is so beautiful. And we learn about the effect that Schiaparelli's memoir had on the young Patty. And Patricia Volk believes that everyone has a transformative book, and usually they read it just before adolescence. So this is a good question for all of us. What is our transformative book? And would we still enjoy it if we reread it now? The book also addresses the very limited options open to women before feminism opened the world of opportunity. In researching the book, Patricia had the wonderful job of doing research in Paris, and she visited Schiaparelli's 21 Place Vendôme atelier. She said, I want to be buried here. They have butterflies in glass domes hanging from the ceiling, Giacometti coffee tables and lamps. They have big black flat boxes with Schiaparelli jewels. And now, thanks to Patricia, I have a beautiful Schiaparelli jewel myself. Patricia Volk is the author of the memoir Stuffed, Adventures of a Restaurant Family. She wrote the novel White Light and two short story collections. She has published stories, book reviews, essays in numerous magazines, and was a weekly columnist for New York Newsday. A recipient of a Guggenheim Fellowship, she has taught at Columbia, NYU, and Bennington. She lives in New York City. And now let us welcome Patricia Volk.
Thank you so much, Jeanette. Jeanette's mother was a Powers girl. Is that what they were called? John Robert Powers was a man who discovered very, very beautiful women. And a lot of them went on to have Hollywood careers or were models who were squired around town. And I think of your mother at El Morocco. But we have something else in common, which is a love for this library. Much of Shocked was written here. I don't know if you're aware of it, but on the fifth floor, there's a huge room. Is it called the Whitbridge Room? I think Whitbridge Room. The Hornblower Room. Oh, how interesting, because Robert Caro's transformative book was Horatio Hornblower, and Barack Obama's transformative book was The Power Broker by Robert Caro. So anyway, I came here to work, and when Eudora Welty once said, when you're working on a book, everything that happens for some reason relates to that book. And upstairs on the fifth floor in this vast room, a lot of time is spent typing, but a lot of time is also spent like this, because you're thinking. And I was thinking in my little favorite corner of that big room, and suddenly my eyes fell on this book called The Book Review Digest. I had never known such a thing existed, but it has every review of every book that was published year by year. So I looked up 1954, which was when Schiaparelli published her memoir, Shocking Life, and there were all these reviews, and I had loved that book. I had even loved it rereading it as an adult. Every review was terrible. She never wrote another book. But it was, I don't think I would have, it added so much to my book to know how her book was received. The way I got started writing on this book, it was kind of like a perfect storm. In 2003, the Philadelphia Museum of Art had a retrospective of Schiaparelli's work. They came to get her clothes because she went bankrupt in 1954. But in 1964, someone from the Costume Institute went to Paris, to 22 Rue de Berry, where she lived, and asked her if they could have her clothes. Well, Schiaparelli was nothing if not disdainful and oppositional, and she never said yes to anything unless she thought of it. And she said, absolutely not. So the woman went downstairs and was leaving the courtyard, this cobblestone courtyard. It was a very grand house. And suddenly Schiaparelli flung open these French doors from a parapet and threw down all her clothes to the woman, who took them back, and they formed the PMA's Schiaparelli collection. It's the best one open to the public in New York, in the world. There are private collectors, but this is one that is in a museum. That was a typical Schiaparelli move. So that was one thing that happened. I couldn't go to the show, but my wonderful friend Molly Haskell, who got extremely tired of me talking about Schiaparelli, said, "Could you raise your hand just so people can see you're so pretty?" She said, "You know, somebody sent me the big book from the PMA. Would you like it?" And this is a tome. This defines tome. It's this big. It's what Schiaparelli deserved, and she gave it to me. So even though I was finishing up another book, Schiaparelli was percolating. The second thing that happened was my mother got sick a couple of years after that, and I went down to Florida to visit her, and I remembered that she had a bottle of shocking from our childhood that she'd never thrown out. And I loved this bottle. I thought it was the most valuable thing that our family owned, because every year on my mother's birthday, my father gave her a bottle of Schiaparelli. Shocking. The name of the perfume was Shocking. And he made the wrapping paper himself out of as many $100 bills as it took to get the job done. And he was a restaurant man, so he got home late, but he'd shake my sister and I awake, and he'd say, "I'm going to give Mom a present. Come on in." We'd come in, and she'd open these $100 bills, and there would be the shocking. And then she'd throw her arms around his neck, and she'd put one leg up when she kissed him. It was very Hollywood. And and that was a very precious bottle. It stayed on her mirrored vanity, and it was the last thing she did with her elaborate maquillage. It took her about 45 minutes to make up every day, even though she was considered the most beautiful woman in the world by our family, by a five-block radius of four generations. She wore an awful lot of makeup, and the last thing she did would be to take the dauber. It was gold, and it had a crystal stem, and put it behind her ears and on her wrists, her pulse points. And if she was going out in the evening, she'd put it in her décolleté and behind her knees as well. She would tell me how the bottle was made, that it had 20 pieces and took 30 people to put together. The flowers, there were 12 of them, and they were all different, and the stamens were different than the petals. The flowers were made on the island of Murano. Then wires were affixed to them, and then they were joined and wrapped in florist tapes until they came into a bunch, and they were held on the neck of the bottle by gilt cord. They went into the gilt cord, and the whole thing was covered with a membrane. And when the membrane broke, that meant the bottle was used. And this was a cloth measuring tape, and where the navel would be, there was a Schiaparelli medallion with a logo. This was shocking pink velvet. This was gold. This glass was made in Bohemia and silk-screened God only knows where, but you could feel it. It was three-dimensional. It was a very, very beautiful object, and it was based on the mannequin of Mae West's body. Mae West, Schiaparelli did a lot of work for the movies. She dressed many movie stars, and she gave Joan Crawford her broad shoulders, and Joan Crawford just wore them to death. Finally, Scab said, "Joan, enough with the shoulders. However you say, assez avec the shoulders." But Joan Crawford loved that look. It was manly, and it made her waist look small. Anyway, so She was going to make the costumes for a Mae West movie, and Mae West was going to come to Paris, but she couldn't at the last minute, so she had a plaster cast made of her body, a mannequin, and Scap built the clothes on that. When she sent the clothes to Hollywood, Mae West had put on a lot of weight, and all of them had to have extenders in the back. And so in that movie, you basically only see Mae West from the front. But that is Mae West's perfectly proportioned body. And so I loved that bottle. When my mother left the house, I would play elaborate games with it. I would pretend it was a movie star. It was, sort of. And sometimes I would pretend I was a shopkeeper, and a man would come in wanting the perfect present for his wife, and I would speak with a French accent, "May I help you?" And it was just me and the bottle, but I loved the bottle. So that was the second thing that happened. And the third thing that happened was I learned about eBay. I had never heard of that America had an online auction house. This was in about 2005. And I went on eBay, and the first thing I typed in was Schiaparelli. And over 500 things came up. And among them was the book that I had read when I was very little. And I read it again, and now I really had, I guess you could call it a case. I couldn't get Schiaparelli off my brain, and I started thinking of, when I reread the book, I realized what a part she had played in my life, that she had been my transformative book. My mother got books and read them every day between 3 and 7. She got them at Womrath's, which was a place where you could, oh, I see heads nodding, where you could rent a book. I think it was 3 days for 25 cents and 10 cents for every day over. And I didn't want to read my sister's books. She was reading, first she started with the series books like The Bobbsey Twins and Nancy Drew. But by the time I was 10, she was 11, and she wants me to say when I tell people about the book she read that by then she was reading The Good Earth, which was her transformative book. And we didn't have anything like the New York Society Library on the east, on the west side. We lived at 83rd and Riverside Drive. And my mother refused to go to the public library because it was on Amsterdam Avenue. My mother had opinions about everything, including avenues. And as you can see, I asked New York mapmaker John Tornack to make me a map of Manhattan without the streets that my mother didn't approve of. So here you see we go from Riverside Drive to West End Avenue. Amsterdam, Broadway, Amsterdam, and Columbus are completely missing. But there is Central Park West, and that is how New York would look like if what New York would look like if my mother designed it. So I reread the book, and I realized that although I didn't have the words to describe it when I was a kid, that it was my transformative book. It was the book that allowed me to separate from my mother, and I thought I was supposed to be like her as much as possible. But there were things about my mother I did not want to emulate. Her career choice, she was pre-law at NYU, but then she gave birth to my sister when she was 19 and decided she couldn't go to law school, and she worked with my father in the family restaurant. She was the glamorous hostess who manned the red velvet rope. And her mother had done that before in another one of our family restaurants, but that wasn't what I wanted to do. The one thing I was good at was drawing, and I wanted to be an artist. And I also felt that my mother was very beautiful, and that was the collateral that she thought a woman had, but it was God-given. And I knew early on that I wanted to do something that I earned. And I also knew that beauty didn't last, because I had my paternal grandmother. Where's my cousin? We had the same grandmother. That's Heather Dubrow, the poet. Granny Ethel was known as the most beautiful woman in Princeton, and she once received a letter addressed, "Postman, postman, do your duty. Deliver this letter to the Princeton beauty." And it got to her. And so she was the first calendar bank girl for the first bank of Princeton on Nassau Street, and this was their first calendar picture, and it was of Granny Ethel. But by the time I knew Granny Ethel, it would be hard to call her a beauty. And Even though she was still spoken of as a great beauty in the family, she was an old lady and wonderful, but no longer a beauty. So I didn't think my future could count on how I looked. Aside from that, I was considered to have a very big problem. They said my eyes were okay, and people liked my hair because it was naturally curly then. But my lips, according to my mother and the dentist, lacked rhythm. And I was given an exercise to do to develop rhythm in my lips. And I had to do it 3 times a day for 100 times. And basically what it was tucking my lips in till they became invisible and holding it and then letting them go. And this gave my mother permission to, like, tap me on the back of the head 3 times a day and say, do your lips exercises yet? It was really like, it was awful. I found that my mother and Elsa Schiaparelli had a lot in common, so that I could take a chance and try to be my own person, somebody else, without it being too big a risk. And the things they had in common were, Well, they both had foul tempers. They both were served breakfast in bed. Schiaparelli had a slice of lemon in a cup of hot water. And my mother had coffee and a piece of dry toast. They both wanted to be very, very slender. Both were perfectionists. Both believed in the importance of good manners. Both required large stretches of time alone. Both were private and did not reveal themselves in any way, their innermost feelings. Both believed if you don't have a ton of money, just buy one or two great things. And my mother, Scap, did have a ton of money for a long time, but my mother kept 22 hangers in her closet. She had 3 favorite designers, her 3 Bs, Jeffrey Bean, Donald Brooks, and Bill Blass. And if she bought a new Bill Blass, she'd give an old one away. So here we are, my glamorous sister and me and my mother, all dressed in my mother's clothes, even though I'm 5'7". My sister was 5'9", my mother was 5'5". We made it work. The clothes were so great that we made it work. She dressed simply. Actually, I remember this suit. It was bright blue with a white stripe on the top. It was a Gino Paoli knit. My sister's was a Donald Brooks, and I think my mother's 3-piece suit was a Bill Blass. But so my mother, because of this constant turnover in her closet, everyone we knew wore her clothes. I mean, relatives, the housekeeper. We thought we were very, very lucky. Both of them were superstitious. My mother believed that if you forgot something and had to come back in the apartment, you had to sit down before you left again. You could never put a hat on a bed. Pillowcases always had to be opened away from the door because spirits could get in them otherwise. And Scap was extremely superstitious, too. All of her perfumes had to start with the letter S. This is Soleil, a collaboration with Salvador Dali she did after the war. It's a Baccarat bottle, and her symbol of freedom was always the bird, so the features of the sun are birds, and there's one on eBay now for $25,000. The bottle, they were never called perfume bottles, they were called perfume presentations, because, like, shocking, she made them very elaborate. When a woman used her perfume, there was a tremendous amount of ritual and feminine behavior involved in even opening a bottle. This came in a beautiful gold scalloped shell with an upholstered inside, and you pressed a button, and the shell would kind of yawn open, revealing the bottle. So this is what she did at the end of the war. It's one of my favorites. But this was the first perfume for men. This came out in 1939. And I think the pipe was a nod to Magritte, Ceci n'est pas une pipe, which he did in 1929. Because that wasn't really a pipe, it was a painting of a pipe, and this wasn't really a pipe, it was a bottle. And I think the box, which is just so lovely. Oh, sorry. Oh. Okay. The box, I think, was a nod to Gerald Murphy, who had done a wonderful painting of his cigar box before the war. So she didn't mind this crossover, and she loved artists. She loved working with artists, and she kind of blurred the line between art and fashion. And whenever she could, she gave poor artists work. And I loved that about her. And there were more similarities. Both of them chain-smoked. Both were terrible drivers, and both wished they could sing, but they couldn't. The differences between them were wonderful for me. My mother was pathologically modest. I never saw her undressed. Once I saw her in a slip, and I didn't know what to do. I knew I wasn't supposed to see her in the slip. But Schiaparelli was very free with her body. This is a photograph of her in a dress called the see-through dress. Man Ray took the picture, and she wore it. I believe she's the only person who did. She loved using new materials, and this was some kind of combination of plastic and voile. And my mother was proper and cared what people thought about her, but Scap was transgressive, a true renegade, a subversive who loved to shock. My mother told me men and women could never be friends, that men only wanted one thing, and it was just an impossible thing to have a friendship with a man, but Scap was friends with lots of men. Man Ray, Dali, Duchamp, the Giacometti brothers, Picasso, Stravinsky. She had many, many male friends. So I thought, oh, this is good to know. one was a great beauty. That was my mother. That's what she looked like. And Scap planted the idea that imagination trumped beauty. She was told by her mother when she was a child, always told by her mother that she was very ugly. And she had been born covered with black moles on her face. And when she was about six, she decided that the cure for this would be to plant her face. And she would, she convinced the gardener to give her seeds from her favorite plants. They were morning glories. They're the ones that she used on her shocking bottles. Morning glories, I think pansies, and something else. And she planted her face. She stuck them up her nose. She stuck them in her tear ducts. She stuck them everywhere. And she watered her face. And she thought her whole head would come into bloom. And that night at dinner, her mother noticed that she had trouble eating. And she said, "What is it?" And Elsa told her what she had done, and they called the doctor. And she had put these seeds in so deep that they had to be extracted from her sinuses. But I always wondered if she told that story to this. The name of this painting is Necrophiliac Springtime, and it's by Salvador Dali. And Scap, it was given to Scap by Dali. He gave her things and collaborated with her, and she dressed Gala Dali, his wife. But here's the head in Necrophiliac Springtime, just a mass of flowers. But here's what she looked like. And she thought the moles were terrible until her uncle, Giovanni Schiaparelli, who was the foremost astronomer in Europe in the world at that time, took her to his observatory, the La Brera Observatory in Milan, and told her he had positioned the telescope, and he said, "Look through there, what do you see?" And he said, "That's the Big Dipper, and that's what's on your face." So, of course, I had to see if it really was. And that's pretty close to the Big Dipper. And after that, she no longer felt ugly, and she would, when she became a famous couturier, the most famous couturier in the world for 20 years, she used the constellation of the Big Dipper in so many ways, as a print on fabrics, She used it in jewelry. She used it, beat it onto jackets. The thing that she was ashamed of became the thing that she was proud of, and she turned it into an asset. And I thought as a child that that was one of the most wonderful things that could happen. And here she is wearing a pin that Cartier designed for her of the Big Dipper under her moles. So she's at the races with Salvador Dali. So she was transgressive, and my mother always played by the rules. And to scap no was another way of saying yes. And perhaps there's no better example of that than the Exposition International in 1937 in Paris. The Seine was lined with different countries representing their modern work. And Jean Lavin was in charge of couture for this show. And she had commissioned an artist to make these huge terracotta behemoths to wear the clothes. And Schiaparelli said, I'm not going to do that. My butterfly silhouette will not look good on that. And Jean Lavin said, fine, if you don't want to do it, you don't have to be in the show. So here's what Schiap did. She put the mannequin naked, holding gloves. And then from these faux trees, she hung a clothesline with all the clothes on it. And it created a sensation. Police had to be brought in to keep people. Men left their calling cards under her rear end. This is all flowers. It's a little hard to see, but she's clearly in plein air naked. And I thought, years later, it occurred to me that that may have been the inspiration for Etant Donné, Marcel Duchamp's wonderful installation in the Philadelphia Museum of Art. You don't see it just like this when you go. You have to look through a door and two peepholes, and from the peepholes you see this exploded wall with a naked woman on her back in plein air holding something. And I've always felt that Schiaparelli was the... He worked on it for 20 years, and it's a permanent thing, and it's worth going to Philadelphia just to see this. It's just extraordinary. Jasper Johns called it the most unusual work of art in any museum anywhere. So Schiap was very good at getting around things and breaking rules. And one thing that she did, and she liked in-jokes. When the Duchess of Windsor was getting married, she took 18 Schiaparelli dresses for her trousseau. And she wanted to show the world that she had a fabulous sense of humor, that she wasn't this evil woman who had, you know, taken the Duke of Windsor, you know, the king and seduced him. So she asked Schiaparelli to make her 18 dresses, and this is the famous lobster dress. And the Duchess thought it was going to show the world that she had a wonderful sense of humor. But you can see where the claws are. They're between her legs. And Schiaparelli, that was another example of Schiaparelli's insouciance. And she also had patents. These are her collapsible glasses. As you can see, there are no earpieces. So she just thought out of the box all the time. I think she amused herself, and she amused the world. And yet her things were objects of beauty. I think she believed very, very highly in André Breton's Surrealist Manifesto, which said, the marvelous is always beautiful. Anything marvelous is beautiful. Indeed, nothing but the marvelous is beautiful. And by that standard, Elsa Schiaparelli was quite beautiful. Here's a collaboration with an artist that she worked with, Cocteau. The embroidery was done by the firm Lesage, which is still in business, but you can see it's either a vase or two people kissing, or maybe it's both. The original color was midnight blue, but it's faded. And here's a collaboration. Oh, sorry. Well, okay, this is me in Paris at... 21 Place Vendôme at the at the at And I'm wearing the Man Ray eyeglasses that Man Ray made for Schiaparelli. And behind me is a torchiere that the Giacometti brothers made for Schiaparelli's old atelier. Most of the things that were in the atelier were preserved, and it's just wonderful to go there. It's the most beautiful building. This was a collaboration. First, this is Venus of the Drawers by Dalí. Each drawer was supposed to contain the scent of that part of the woman where the drawer is. I'm not sure what knees do, but anyway, and then Schiaparelli made the drawer, the desk suit, she called it, and it had hardware and drawers. The pockets actually opened like drawers. And I think she's carrying La Lanterne, which is a handbag they collaborated on. It had a street lamp on the outside so you could light your way home at night. But perhaps her most copied item was the madcap, and here Katharine Hepburn is wearing it. All it was a tube of jersey or knit that was sewn closed at one end, and women could wear it all different kinds of ways. And in Paris, if you copied a hat, they have very different laws there. If you copied a hat, you could go to jail. But Albert Solomon, a man in New York, copied it here, and he did not have to do any time for that. And it's still in use. In fact, he started the company Madcaps, made millions of dollars, and moved to Saratoga Springs and played the horses. But all babies are sent home now today in Madcaps. And that's my first grandson in his Madcap. I'm going to show you three favorite things that I love of Schiaparelli's, my top three. This is the bug necklace, and it was worn by Daisy Fellows, Mrs. Reginald Fellows, who was, I guess, the Nan Kempner of that era. There were three women, and everybody watched what they wore, and Schiaparelli had stolen them, not stolen them, they defected from the House of Chanel to the House of Schiaparelli. And they were Daisy Fellows, Millicent Rogers, and I'll think of the other one in a minute. Anyway, a beautiful woman would go out at night. This was made on see-through material called rhodoid, and she was the first one to use it. She loved discovering new materials. The bugs were made by Jean Schlumberger, who she collaborated with. And they were very naturalistic. And they made tons of jewelry together. They were known as Scap and Schlum. And so a woman would go out with this, and you would see her skin through the rhodoid, and it would look as if she had bugs crawling all over her. And that Scap loved that. The Surrealists loved insects, especially the butterfly. This is Scap's butterfly dress. The back of it it has no back. And she covered the dress with butterfly netting. The coat is made out of butterfly net. And it was accessorized with a parasol of butterflies so that the butterflies flew above your head. Just imagine wearing an evening gown and carrying a parasol. But women could get away with that. And this is the sweater that changed Schiaparelli's life. In 1929, a friend of hers wore a sweater, and she liked the sturdy way that it was knit. She had never seen a knit like that. And she said, "Who made this for you?" And it was a woman called Arusi Agmichielian. And Scap was introduced to her, and she said, "If I draw a sweater, could you make it for me?" So she drew this very primitive bow. Scap herself called it primitive. And Arusi Agmichielian, whose name Scap called her Mike, and they worked together for 20 years, went through three trials and finally got it just the way Scap wanted it. And there was going to be a huge buyer's luncheon at the Ritz, and Scap timed it so she would get there late after everyone was seated. And she walked in wearing the sweater. A buyer from Lord & Taylor was there. They ordered 40 on the spot and 40 skirts to go with it. And Schiaparelli rounded up all these, had Mike round up all these Armenians who were knitting like a frenzy, and Vogue covered the sweater, and she was off and running. By then she had a backer, and that was the beginning of everything. Well, I thought that I would have this sweater knit for me to wear to readings. Excuse me. About 6 weeks before I was going to do the first reading, I thought I should get that sweater. So I went all over New York looking for someone who would make it for me, and no one wanted to touch it. I finally found a woman on 92nd and Madison who said she would do it, but she would not do the Armenian stitch. The Armenian stitch uses two different colors for every stitch. One is tucked under and one comes over. So when you want to do the white, you bring out the white, and when you want to do the black, you bring out the black. But it's very tweedy and very heavy. Anyway, this woman said she would do it, but she would not do the Armenian stitch. For $850, she would just knit a black sweater with a white thing on it. And I really didn't want that. So I knew that there had been a sweater kit at the PMA show, and I called Dillis Blum, who's the curator of the Costume Institute there, and I said, do you have any of them left? And she said, no. And I said, well, who knit the sweater for you that you used in the show? And she said, oh, that was Meg Larson of Schoolhouse Press. She made the kit. So I called Meg. This is how the computer can really change your life. I found Meg. I called her. And I said, could you knit the sweater for me in 6 weeks? She said, oh, I didn't knit the sweater. A friend of mine knit it. So I said, well, could you ask her if she'd knit the sweater for me using the Armenian stitch? And she said, you know what? Her husband just died. She's looking for something to do. I bet she'd do it for you. Well, Meg called back and said, guess what? I asked her if she'd do it, and she said she wouldn't knit that sweater again for Michelle Obama. But Meg found me some. This whole country is knit together by a site called Ravelry.com. That's where knitters go to talk to each other. And she found me this wonderful woman in Texas, Mariam Hakim, who said she'd be happy to knit it for me in 6 weeks for $250. I did wear it to the first reading, and it's so hot. It's because of the tooth wools. It's like wearing a parka in a sauna. But here's the sweater. I counted the stitches for her, so it's exactly like scap. And here's the back. Here's the back. It's really quite beautiful, and if I ever go to Nome, Alaska, I'm going to be wearing it. But as you can see, it's two things. It's kind of amazing how it's made. So this is my favorite Schiaparelli because it's mine. I think that what I realized reading Scap's book was that anything was possible, that the constraints that my mother thought were necessary to becoming a woman meant absolutely nothing. Schiaparelli made a hat out of a shoe, and it's being worn here by Dalla Ghali, and she's wearing a Schiaparelli suit. These are Lee Miller's lips. Lee Miller was the lover of Man Ray and a great photographer and also a great beauty. And Man Ray did a painting of her lips in the sky. You probably know it. Anyway, I just knew that if a shoe could be a hat could be a shoe. Thank you. If anybody has a question, yes. Yes, the perfume was made by one of the big noses in Paris, Jean Charles. It was floral and spicy, and it had musk in it. And today perfumers say that it is skank, that is the smell. Schiaparelli's mission with this perfume was to make it smell like a woman's flesh when it was very warm. Yes.
Oh.
But now everyone wears kind of organic.
Do you wear a perfume?
Yes, I love perfume.
What do you wear?
I ordered it because of the name. It's called Portrait of a Lady.
Oh. I love perfume. My friend Susan, by the way, part of this book was written here, and part of it was written at Susan and Charlie's house, the last draft of it. It was the perfect, I had a terrible deadline with this book, and I could never thank you enough for that. And Susan wears a perfume I love. We've never talked about it, but it isn't a light perfume. It smells like roses to me. Is it something made just for you?
Diorissimo.
Diorissimo? Oh, my God, I figured it was something made like in a, you know. Well, it's fabulous. I love it. I wear perfume. I don't feel like I'm dressed unless I'm wearing it. But I can't wear shocking. It's just, there's something shocking about it. It's just, no, but I have a feeling they're going to again. They don't. The Australians got the license to remake it. But I've never seen it in this country. You had your hand up?
What was the relationship between Schiaparelli and Chanel?
Oh, well, Chanel was the toast of the town till Schiaparelli came. And the three people, all the leading people defected to Schiaparelli. Chanel hated Schiaparelli. She called her that Italian who thinks she can make clothes. And Schiaparelli called Chanel that bourgeois hat maker. And, ouch. But really, it was much more, Schiaparelli really didn't have time to, or the inkling to have a real grudge against Chanel. But June was ball month in Paris. And some of these balls were so incredibly elaborate. Some of them were costume balls. And the Bal de Forêt, the forest ball, Schiaparelli went as a tree. She had this new fabric that looked like bark, and she made limbs, and she was just quite fabulous. And Chanel always came as in a little black dress. She would never wear a costume. But she asked Schiaparelli to dance. Women danced with women then. And they were doing a foxtrot, and Chanel was leading, and she backed Schiaparelli into a wall of candles, and Schiaparelli went up like that. And luckily, there were a lot of seltzer siphons around, and everybody put her out. But Chanel was very, very jealous of Schiaparelli and outraged that she had lost her clients. Yes, Charlie.
Do you see any resemblance between Schiaparelli's use of strange things for garments with Lady Gaga?
Well, I think Lady Gaga was totally inspired by Schiaparelli. Lady Gaga's meat dress, you know? Schiaparelli did, for her circus collection, a dress that looked like flesh torn off a body. Dali painted the flesh. It's just the most beautiful dress. That she could make torn flesh look beautiful tells you what kind of an artist she was. Yeah, I think Lady Gaga's been very much inspired by Schiaparelli, and so was Alexander McQueen. Did anybody see the show at the Met? I mean, using industrial paint to do trompe l'oeil on clothes and the eroticism of death. Lady Gaga is straight out of Schiaparelli. That's a great observation. Yes? She was married to Count Willem de Went de Kerlor, who is a cad, a rotter and a cad. She met him when she had come. Her parents didn't know what to do with her. She was in her 20s. She wasn't married. She had written a book of erotic poetry and gotten it published, and it embarrassed the family. And so they sent her to England to work in an orphanage. And she would come to London. First, they sent her to a convent, and she went on a hunger strike, and her father took her home. She was fabulous. And then she went to, so she was in England, and she saw that there was going to be a lecture on theosophy, and she wanted to know about it. So she went to the lecture, and when it was, the man who gave the lecture strode out in, what do they call that kind of wonderful coat? Tails? What do they call? Swallowtail coat, and he was blonde and quite beautiful. And after the lecture was over, she stayed there, and he came over to her, and by the morning they were engaged. But he was a terrible guy, and he left her for Isadora Duncan when she was pregnant, and she only saw him once after that across the street on a road. And she never would marry again. She said she would never give her heart to another man. That said, I think she had plenty of male companions, and I know she had many, many proposals of marriage. Yes. Oh, well, in 1937, I'm glad you asked. In 1937, she brought out Shocking Perfume. And she wanted a color that would go with it, and she wanted it to be a color people had never seen before. She wanted it to be not a color of the West. She wanted it to be a color of Peru. She wanted it to be electric. She wanted it to somehow encompass all the birds, all the animals in the world. She had high expectations for this color. And she asked her friend Jean Clément, the artist, to make this color for her. And he tried 8 times to do it. And each of the 8 times he made 4 samples. And finally on the 9th try, that was the color she saw in her head. It's very, very hard to describe a color. And that was Shocking Pink. And that year that her perfume was launched, I think she was very, very good at promoting. She made her entire collection in Shocking Pink, whether it was silk or wool or whatever. Everything was Shocking Pink. If you wore that color, people knew you had a Schiaparelli. Even her dog's leash, her dog's name was Nuts. Even her dog's leash was Shocking Pink. And she owns that color, and it is a beautiful color. I'd love to. I'm glad you asked that. I thought it was forced. That show was, I'm very glad for anyone who gives money to the Costume Institute because the Met does not support it. It's entirely supported by Anna Wintour and her great ball that she has there every year. That's where the money comes from. And that exhibit was paid for by Jeff Bezos, the owner of Amazon.com. So he had decided to sell Prada on Amazon, and I think this was a way for him to gain even more notice for the brand. But that decision to have that show was made a year or so before the show was launched, and in that year, Prada used Schiaparelli as a reference for many of the designs so that the show could take place. But I thought a lot of the constructs were false. Scap only being the top and Prada being the bottom, that was one of the things they said. Schiaparelli did know that most women were seated at table at night and that their tops were important. But she did an awful lot with bottoms. She invented the culotte. She invented special panties for women to wear riding a bike that if they showed, it was fabulous. She also lengthened the line of a woman. Schiaparelli was not built like the women she dressed. She had a large bust, and she was very short. She was only about 5 feet tall, so she wanted her line to be as long as possible, and that's why many of her clothes seemed to start here, and that's why she liked the bolero jacket. And so I thought she deserved her own show. I'm sure that the Met did not want to play catch-up with the PMA. They had a Schiaparelli show, but I think they could have given her her own show. They could have even done a show. This is the show I would have liked to see, a show where you saw all the people she inspired, like have Lady Gaga's meat dress there and have Galliano's things and Jean-Paul Gaultier, all the people who really owe her so much, including Balenciaga, who used to dissect her clothes so that he could see how they were made, and Yves Saint Laurent, who worshipped her. His favorite object, the thing that he ever made, was Le Smoking, a jacket he made in the 60s for, you're smiling, you know the jacket, for Catherine Deneuve. But Schiaparelli had done that jacket in the 30s, and he worshipped her. And he said, in fact, when Shocking Pink came out, he said, only Schiaparelli could give to a red the nerve of, could give to a pink the nerve of a red. I thought that was marvelous. And when she went out of business, the only two people she would wear, and they dressed her for free, it was an honor to dress her, were Balenciaga and Yves Saint Laurent. Did I answer your question? Joel. That's a really good question. The Diego Della Valle, who owns the Todd's Group, in 2008 bought the rights to use the name Schiaparelli. He seems to have very deep pockets because then he bought all the apartments at 21 Place Vendôme, which is where her atelier was, except for one that wouldn't make itself available. He then redecorated them using all the things that had been in storage, including the gilded cage, a bird cage. Birds were very important to Schiaparelli, that was in the entryway. So once you walked into her maison, you were trapped. You were trapped in a cage, and that's back there. And it's just, if you're going to Paris, you must go to 21 Place Vendôme and see what they've done with the place. It's just beautiful. It's surreal. It's Elsa Schiaparelli. She would love it. So he bought it, and he tried to find a designer to relaunch the brand. Christian Lacroix last year did, I think, 15 pieces, one-offs. They were not going to be reproduced, just to alert the world that Schiaparelli was coming back. And a few months ago, he hired Marco Zanini from Rochas to come over and head the house. And I'm very excited to see what he's going to do. The first collection will be in January, and it's only going to be, there's not going to be any prêt-à-porter, which is what ready-to-wear, which is what something else Schiaparelli invented. It's just going to be the very, very most expensive kind of clothes that are rarely being made anymore. But I've heard that there will also be little things that you can buy that'll be perfect and wonderful but won't break the bank. My mother would never have worn a Schiaparelli dress. They were $5,000 in the 50s. But even then, Schiaparelli wanted everyone to have something Schiaparelli. So she made little heart-shaped soaps. My mother had those, and heart-shaped sachets. And you could, you know, open your drawer and see them and just feel absolutely wonderful. So Schiaparelli is coming back, and stay tuned. Yes, Alex. Oh, my God. Yes. She was horrified when I started buying used clothes. She thought it was disgraceful. She believed very much in being crisp and tucked in. And how you wore the clothes was very important to her. When you sat, you didn't cross your legs. You crossed your legs at the ankle. On my honeymoon, my entire thing was all her used clothes, even her bathing suits. I mean, she liked when I wore her clothes. And so most of my clothes were hers. And I don't know how she felt about jeans. There was a time when I wore a lot of jeans. But she was not happy unless I looked crisp. And I once looked crisp when I met her and a friend for lunch, and she never stopped talking about it. She said, that day you came to, what was Andre Saltner's, what was that wonderful little French restaurant? What? Lutèce. Okay, we met for lunch at Lutèce, and I was wearing my mother's sable boa and a little tweed suit. And she said, till she died, that day you met Muriel and me for lunch at Lutèce. I'll never forget how you looked. But I didn't look like that a lot of the time, I'm afraid. Was your mother pleased with the way you dressed? Oh.
Yeah, I don't think she was particularly happy with
there
were five girls, so.
Oh. I bet. Yes.
How
Oh, that's a great question. Her father was the head of the Lindsay Library, and he was a Sanskrit scholar and a coin collector. He traded with King Victor Emmanuel. And she was exposed very early on to these fabulous illuminated books. In fact, she never learned to sew. She had these books, and she would point to things and say, make it this, make it go in, make this, make that. She used her, you know. Books were very, very important to her, and she loved being alone with her books. She would actually schedule dates with herself, and she would always get dressed up. She put on a turban, she put on her gold mules and her jewelry, and then she'd read. She'd spend the night reading. So I think that because her father had the library and she had free run of it, and the books were just, you know, amazing. They were all very illustrated.
What?
I don't know. I know that she did. She made clothes with Indian motifs and dressed Indian royalty a lot. And I don't know if she went to India. Since there's so much shocking pink in India, I'm kind of wondering about it as you say that. But she had early exposure. She had a very rich visual vocabulary. And the things that she loved when she came to New York that she had never seen before were barbershop poles. She thought they were fabulous, which I've never understood because she was born in Italy. I mean, were those an American invention, barbershop poles? And she did many, many dresses with stripes that went around them like that. She loved that. She loved the verticality of New York. She thought the Flatiron Building and the, well, who doesn't? And the Brooklyn Bridge were just absolutely amazing. She was very influenced by that, and futurism, yeah. But her eyes were, she saw 20 times what other people see. And it gave her great pleasure. Somebody had their hand raised. Oh, yes. Well, in the picture, I had the necklace shot. I bought this necklace and the earrings on eBay. This morning there were 793 Schiaparellis on eBay. Feel free to bid. I've got everything I need now. But my mother never, ever would have worn faux jewelry. Schiaparelli invented wearing fake jewelry that was blatantly fake, and she mixed it with real jewelry. But my mother would never have worn fake jewelry. I had this photographed, and then I had a retoucher strip it on to my mother because I wanted to end the book with the idea that the most beautiful woman in the world was wearing the most beautiful necklace in the world. But she never would have worn this. And if she was here tonight, she'd say, take that off. Where are your pearls? Well, I guess that's it. Thank you.